You're listening to a podcast from 702.
Because we've got bigger fish to fry right now. Talking about drugs of a different kind. The J&J, Johnson & Johnson vaccine, has been paused by the South African government. Very euphemistic terms, if you ask me. And to talk about that decision, South African Health Products Regulatory Authority Chairperson, Professor Helen Rees. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Claire.
So, Professor, break this down for us. And in plain layman's terms, why did we pause this vaccine trial?
Well, I think I'll start right at the beginning. These are new vaccines, as we all know, because the virus is new, so we had to develop new vaccines. Whenever we do studies or roll out new vaccines, we always look very carefully for any safety signals. And then we're very cautious and investigate them very, very carefully, especially if they are serious safety signals. So in this case, we have a 3B trial that's going on in South Africa. But in the United States, they've been rolling out the J&J vaccine, and they've rolled it out to approaching 7 million people now. And they noted 6 cases of this rare thrombotic syndrome. And it seemed to occur more in women and in younger women. So because of this, they want to investigate whether there's any possibility that these are what's called causally associated with the vaccine. What that means is, could these rare cases have an association with the use of the vaccine, or is it just what you see when you roll out to millions of people that rare things happen? And of course they do when you're following people up over time. So that is what's currently happening in the United States, and we're following their investigation very closely.
State for us categorically. I mean, was this decision made off the back of other nations deciding that they need more information on the J&J vaccine, or did we make this decision independently?
No, we made this decision independently, but of course we're able to look at the data that has been generated from our 3B rollout of the J&J vaccine amongst healthcare workers, where we haven't seen this very rare side effect or episode rather. So we haven't seen that here, and we don't have access to all of the information that the United States FDA has. So we're in close contact with them. We're talking to the World Health Organization, that's also looking carefully at any safety signal for any of the vaccines worldwide. But our decision was an independent decision, and it was one really of caution. We really don't know whether this is a causal relationship between this rare side effect and the vaccine, or whether this is a coincidental finding. And in order to understand that, you'd have to do much more digging into what was the profile of the people who developed this problem.
If you just joined us, Professor Helen Rees, the chairperson of the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, tasked with deciding which medical products are safe for us to use. She joins us on the Clement Magnotella show now. Perhaps you want to give her a call and ask your question. Shoot your shot, 011-883-0702. Professor, I mean, we're talking about 6 women between the ages of 18 and 48. And blood clotting, of course, extremely serious and something not to be taken lightly. But 6 women out of a pool of millions? I mean, a lot of people, especially laymen like me, are saying, "Yeah, I'll ride the lightning. I'll try. I want that protection that a vaccine can present to me, and not damn the consequences, but I'm willing to take the risk."
Yes, no, you're spot on here, and this is something that's always very important to think about, what we call risk benefit. The first thing I'm just going to underline is that we have to assess first whether this is associated with the vaccine or its coincidence, and there were other background factors in those women, such as smoking or the pill, that might have predisposed them to this anyway. So that would be number one. But say we think there's possibly an association. This remains extraordinarily rare. And the risk from COVID of thromboembolism is huge in comparison. It's one of the it's part of what we call the pathology of COVID, is that it causes lots of cuts, little cuts, and it causes embolic episodes. And it's one of the reasons why people become so sick with COVID. So if you want to compare the risk from a vaccine, if we find that there is an association, then that's certainly not present. But if you compare that to the risk from getting COVID, even if you're a fit young person like yourself, you know, that risk of thromboembolism with COVID is extremely high. So this is when we start to talk about risk benefits. And what we're seeing with many of the regulatory authorities, the same has been said for the AstraZeneca vaccine, is the benefit of the vaccine to you as an individual and your personal protection, and to society in terms of stopping the transmission of this virus, far outweighs any risk. And so once we have made the first assessment, we will then say, what is the benefit risk assessment? And like you, Nicholas, at the moment, if something was 1 in a million, if it was shown to be an association, I certainly would recommend that my family, my friends, have the vaccine and line up for it. I've had the vaccine as a doctor, and I'm very happy that I've had the vaccine, and I would go again. If I was offered it and hadn't had it, I would certainly have it now, even with that kind of risk.
You know, moving on from a layman's perspective, just as a South African, you can understand that your average person in the street is getting rather frustrated with what seems like a stop-start attempt at trying to get inoculations out to the general populace. Granted, we're far ahead of many other nations on the African continent and indeed the world as well. But do you think that criticism is justified, perhaps? I mean, is SAHPRA in any way, shape or form dragging its feet?
Well, SAHPRA, from the regulatory point of view, no. We haven't, I don't know if that's the right verb, dragged our feet, but we've tried to be very proactive. We've prioritized everything to do with COVID from the drug regulatory point of view, and that includes a whole range of things like diagnostics for the laboratory, ventilators, the sort of the hospital end of PPE, drugs and therapeutics and vaccines. So everything has been fast-tracked. So from the SAHPRA point of view, no, I don't think that there has been any dragging of feet. But I think what sometimes people don't appreciate is that it does take some time to evaluate, for example, a vaccine that's submitted to us to say, is it fit for emergency use? Is it fit for registration? If it's fit for registration, what conditions do you want to attach to it? Because we know these are new vaccines. So there's a whole series of investigations that the regulator has to do about manufacturing sites, the quality of the product, the clinical trial data, the laboratory data. That does take some time. So it's not a sort of 24-hour look. I don't think SAHPRA has caused a delaying factor at all. I think the question would be, will we, and then this is the question the minister answered last night, will we pick enough off the mark to purchase? And then, have we had delays that we should learn from for the future? Were we quick enough to really think through the issue of indemnity? That seemed to take a time. Was Treasury ready to press a go button quickly enough? I mean, I think these are really legitimate questions that we can reflect on retrospectively. But I think let's separate that and say now the stop start. The stop start that we've seen, first of all, for AstraZeneca and now for J&J, are around questions of, in the case of AstraZeneca, are we sure the vaccine will work in the context of our variant? That's number one. And number two, for J&J now, is there or is there not a safety signal? And these are important questions. And what in fact it's telling us is that our systems in South Africa are working because we are listening, looking at the data all the time, and we're responding appropriately. But I totally get it that what everyone wants is a safe, effective vaccine that we press the go button and it's rolled out and it's done efficiently, 100%. But I think in a pandemic, people have to give a bit of wiggle room to the fact that everyone is trying to do that as an end goal, but also having to be cautious as well.
Certainly in an inenviable position that yourself and indeed people in government dealing with the vaccine rollout find themselves in. If you don't want to give us a call, you can also send your SMS questions to Professor Helen Rees of the SA Health Products Regulatory Authority. She's a chairperson. SMS is to 31702 and also WhatsApps as well to 0727021702. Just as a quick sidebar, Prof. Rees, and there's been a hell of a lot of conspiracy theorists out there, people that believe that they're experts based on what they read on the internet, and in some ways it's a little bit unhelpful to air the views of a lot of people, but I think it's also important to try and dispel the myths and the fallacies out there. We've got Anonymous on the SMS line saying, ask this professor that with a brilliant recovery rate and the virus not being as bad as they first thought, are vaccines really necessary? I mean, it seems like a silly question, but I'd like you to address it.
Well, I think I would put the question back to all the listeners to say, is there anyone out there who can honestly say that they don't know anyone who's been seriously affected by COVID, either individuals who haven't had severe disease, individuals who they might know or in their family who have died, or families that they know who have lost somebody. And I think pretty much now, if we ask that question to most people in South Africa, I would say well over 90% of people would say, I know someone who was on a ventilator. I know someone who died. I know a family who's been really affected. You have a disease that indeed, we've looked at the mortality in the second wave, and it increased mortality in the evaluation that's been done by about 20%. That's a huge increase in national deaths. That's people dying. That's often younger people, people in the primes of their lives, people who are parents and caregivers often. So this is not like the average flu that we're seeing. The mortality is indeed much, much higher. So that would be the first thing that I would say. And the second thing is, because so many people are infected, because mortality is high, the social disruption is absolutely huge. And if we have another third wave, similar, for example, to the second, if we got another peak like that and we had to stop the economy yet again, the damage in terms of not only people's mental health and economic health, but the damage to overall health of this country and our economic recovery would be huge. So there's no doubt in most people's mind that the way to break this pandemic is to combine all of the other measures that we're introducing, still the mask wearing, still the social distancing, still all those cautions, but together with a vaccine. And I think that is globally absolutely what everyone who's, you know, a sort of serious scientist that's looking at this has agreed upon.
We are chatting to Professor Helen Rees. I have at least one more question for her, but let's give Mark in Centurion a chance. Mark, thank you very much for giving us a call. You're on the air. Ask Professor Rees your question.
Yeah, good morning, Professor Nicholas. Listen, I just read a very interesting paper from a professor from Stanford University in America that has got an unpronounceable name, but he basically said because between 80 and 85% of the people that are COVID positive, if you had to do the test, are actually asymptomatic. That means they don't have any cough, they don't have any fever, they don't have anything. They don't even know that they've got it. So the real number they might have had or might have been COVID. We could obviously higher because we just actually don't know because we just haven't done the testing. Where he surmises also, and this was also echoed by John Ioannidis, which Professor Rees might have heard of, that the real death rate, therefore, is only between 0.2 and 0.25%. So, Nicholas, if you're saying that only 6 people out of a million have died, I mean, there's other people that have died in Germany quite a while ago already, 10, and those were older people that basically died within 4 days of taking the shot, including deaths in Norway and other countries, then you've got to say, look, if it's only a death rate of 0.2 or 0.25% and the recovery rate is in the high 90%, why not just take the chance of trying to ride out this COVID wave? Don't get COVID at all if you can avoid it, but if you do, the chances are just as good as taking a vaccine for something that you don't even know is going to affect you. It might even kill you in the long run.
Mark, let's wait for Prof. Rees to reply there. I mean, Is that a cogent argument, Prof. Rees? I mean, you've answered that question already in many ways, but what do you say to people that still want to risk the the possibility of getting COVID? And you know, there's some people that, you know, in the same WhatsApp group as those that don't want to give their children vaccines when they're born, they believe that, you know, vaccines are evil. Vaccines, we just don't know what's in them.
Well, I think that just starting with your last point, I think it's a real minority of people who think vaccines are evil. I mean, and to some extent, we're not going to be able to persuade people who are really, really strong in that viewpoint. I think the legitimate group that we as scientists should be talking to are the worried well who are being asked in the future to have a vaccine and are saying, well, are you sure about safety? Are you sure that this will work? The kind of questions that Mark was saying is, what's the risk-benefit there? I mean, if the mortality is low. And as I said, I think in answer to Mark's question, there's several things. One is that figure of 80 to 85% isn't the figure that generally held. We think that asymptomatic disease is probably about 40%. And in fact, quite a lot of people have mild to moderate disease, and that next category is about 40%. And then the top 20% would be severe disease, some of whom will end up in hospital, and at the far end you have a mortality, which, depending on where you are, will vary between sort of 2 to 4%. But it varies on the ability of the health system to manage. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you cannot get away from the fact that during the second wave, numbers of deaths, and overall, if we look at the last year, we have seen more deaths in this country associated with COVID than we would normally see in a normal average year. Now, that could be due to COVID itself as a disease being causing those excess deaths. But in addition to that, it's the pressure on health services that occurs when you have a big wave. People can't access health services. Health services are less able to cope. So the risk of dying, even if you end up in hospital, might be increased because of the absolute pressure on health services. Whatever way you look at it, that is more people dying in the last year than we would have expected. And as I say, the figure that we so far got was about 20% higher. But there are other things to think about. One is that the issue of what's called long COVID is now being really recognized that it is a real phenomenon. This virus is really nasty. It affects not only your blood vessels, which is what we've just been talking about. It affects the organs. It affects the heart. We know it affects the lungs. Everyone's familiar with that. It affects the brain. It can affect all of the other major organs like the kidneys. And about 15% depends where you look, but in countries where they've got better surveillance systems and have really been looking at this, like the UK, they're saying that about 15% have quite significant symptoms of long COVID, and that can be just a very long time to recover. A lot of people talk about this absolute lack of energy, lack of ability to do things, shortness of breath, but also the mental effects. People talk about anxiety, depression. There's records now of psychosis. People are talking in older people about precipitation of dementia. The fact that this is such a disseminated virus really is causing long-term effects in those figures, about 15% of people. So, yes, mortality is one thing. If I had a choice today between a vaccine and getting COVID, I for sure would take a vaccine. I don't want long COVID. I don't want to be seriously in hospital. I don't want to be gasping for breath. I don't want to infect them. So that would be my answer.
Last but not least, we've got Anonymous on the WhatsApp line. I would like to find out from the good professor, how long does it normally take for a vaccine to pass the testing phase to being approved and certified for rollout? I'm no professional in this field, but from the limited knowledge I have, it surely takes up to 10 years and there's need for testing it even on animals. Did we really take the time to do the same on this one as well? Or are we just running it out because it's an emergency and we haven't felt the effects that the vaccine may well have?
It's a very good question, but I would say two things to this. One is I've been part of a global enterprise called CEPI for several years since the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, and that was set up with global public funds to invest in vaccines to accelerate the development of vaccines, because what everyone recognized with the Ebola outbreak was it just takes far too long especially in the face of an emergency, to develop a vaccine. So our approach to developing vaccines has been accelerated, not just now, but it goes back. It goes back certainly to the Ebola outbreak. And what we've been doing as a global health community is investing in what we call candidate vaccines. These are vaccines that for pathogens that we might think will cause an outbreak, like you might have heard of Lassa fever, for example. So we've been looking at pathogens that might cause an outbreak in the future and investing now in vaccine candidates. But we've also been investing in what we call vaccine platforms. And everyone's now heard of Pfizer and Moderna. That's an mRNA, and it's called a platform because it's a sort of a vaccine platform that you can plug antigen, as you call it, onto it quite quickly. And so we've set the scene for accelerated development of vaccines. That's the first thing. The second thing we recognized is that we've taken far too long in the way that we traditionally do clinical trials. We'll do something, we'll pause, we'll analyze, it'll take some months, even a year, and then we'll go on to the next phase. And instead of that, what we've done is that we've actually said, can we integrate these phases of clinical trials to accelerate? Have all the phases in there? Yes, but not have these long gaps of thinking and adjustment, but push as quickly as we can. The third question you're asking is, have we done the animal studies? Yes. There's a whole global group of scientists who WHO has also been convening that have looked at what is the best animal model to develop here. And a lot of work has been done, and animal studies indeed continue to be done. They're very important, as are the laboratory studies that are being done globally, but also here in South Africa, to evaluate the effectiveness of these vaccines. So the answer is, you're right, it's much, much, much quicker, extraordinarily quick. Did we press the go button last January? No, we didn't. We were preparing for this, and that allowed us to go in a much more rapid trajectory towards the vaccine.
Professor Helen Rees, thank you for taking time to explain in minute detail where we are. And let's hope that in coming weeks, we can begin to understand when not only the J&J vaccine will be back in action, but indeed as well, how the overall government attempts to bring vaccines to South Africa is going. As a parting shot, though, Prof. Rees, do you think that we're on course? Do you think that there should be hope in terms of government's attempts to bring vaccines en masse to South Africans?
Yes, I do. I do. I'm optimistic that we've indeed got, remember, we've got both J&J and Pfizer that have now been ordered, and I'm very optimistic that we're going to get those and we're going to be able to roll them out. And just sort of personally and anecdotally, I'm getting many more people who every time they see me say, when are we getting the vaccine then? I don't want the vaccine. I think most people, even if there was a causality here, would still say, listen, one in a million versus COVID infection, please give me the vaccine.
Professor Helen Rees joining us on the Clement Manyatela Show.